Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
On this Labor Day, a dispute between the president and a union leader over the future of NAFTA. Canada, anyone? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 3rd of September. Happy Labor Day, everyone. President Trump fired back at union leader Richard Trumka today, tweeting that the head of the AFL-CIO had represented workers poorly over the weekend. In an interview with Fox News yesterday, Trumka criticized the administration's policies for workers and said any deal to renegotiate NAFTA must include Canada. Talks between the U.S. and Canada are expected to resume Wednesday. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris starts us off.
Negotiations over NAFTA will take time, says Laura Dawson with the Canada Institute at the Wilson Center, because there's a lot to work out and much of it is very technical.
From pesticide residue on plants to how you measure the quality and cut of meat.
Among the issues still to resolve, dairy exports, intellectual property protection, and cars. NAFTA's been in effect for almost 25 years, so there's been substantial integration between the economies of the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, particularly in sectors like energy and automotives. Michael Moore, professor of economics and international affairs at George Washington University, says many North American businesses already have existing cross-border contracts. And if Canada were out of NAFTA 2.0...
These are multi-billion dollar investments that were initiated under the assumption that you would have a free market in North America. And it would be enormously disruptive if Canada is not part of that.
President Trump, it's hoped, could sign a deal by November 30th. Christopher Sands, who runs the Center for Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins University, thinks that's optimistic.
We've played this game with NAFTA from the beginning, with deadlines that appear to be quite final but then stretch into the future.
However long and tense the negotiations turn out to be, the U.S. and Canada have quite an incentive to work something out. Trade between the two nations is worth some $670 billion. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Also happening Wednesday, representatives from Facebook, Google, and Twitter are scheduled to testify at a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. They'll be grilled on what their platforms are doing to prevent meddling in U.S. elections. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Google's CEO is apparently sending a lower-level executive to the hearing, but Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg and Twitter's CEO Jack Dorsey will be testifying. Twitter has reportedly closed almost 800 accounts for coordinated manipulation, and
some of them are old, you know, so some of them have been around for more than a year.
Stephanie Miller is a senior analyst at Height Capital Markets. She thinks members of Congress will ask,
why does it take so long? What are you doing to try to expedite that? Because you have to imagine that a lot of damage potentially could be done in that amount of time.
Miller says Facebook is also under pressure. It recently announced that it removed more than 600 fake accounts from Iran and an undisclosed number of Russian accounts. Clint Watts is with the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Watts said Facebook is facing a heavy lift.
You cannot screen fake news as fast as it can be made. And same thing with extremist propaganda.
Watts added that Facebook is trying to automate the process, developing artificial intelligence to do the screening. But for now, it's relying on humans. Facebook says it's going to double the number of people working on security to 20,000 by the end of this year. That's not cheap. Richard Greenfield is media and tech analyst at BTIG. He says Facebook told investors, look, this is going to cost us.
So you've got revenue slowing, cost going up, and the result is less profit than was previously expected.
Greenfield says revenues for Facebook this year will keep growing, but they'll go from around 50% growth at the beginning of the year to maybe 30% by the end. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street today closed for the workers' holiday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The tide of migrants attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe has slowed since its peak a few years ago. But a new report from the United Nations Refugee Agency says those crossings have become more deadly. So far this year, more than 1,600 people have died or gone missing. After Italy recently closed its ports to rescue ships, the Western Mediterranean route from Morocco to Spain is now the most popular for those trying to reach Europe. The BBC's Damian Grammaticus has this story from the Strait of Gibraltar.
Over the radio, Spanish Coast Guard send an alert to all shipping. An inflatable dinghy with up to 50 migrants crammed aboard is adrift in the Strait of Gibraltar. The Spanish rescue boat reaches the rubber craft. It's being tossed to and fro on the waves, dangerously close to a cargo ship. Crossing one of the world's busiest shipping lanes like this is a desperate risk to take. First the children, then the adults are pulled onto the rescue craft. In the Spanish port of Algeciras, right next to Gibraltar, they're brought ashore. Those from Morocco and Algeria are separated out. Spain has special agreements with their countries to send them back. So they're loaded onto buses to be deported within hours. Those from sub-Saharan countries are allowed to stay and make asylum applications. So left slumped on the quayside is Una Sally from Ivory Coast. She's exhausted, cradling a little girl in her lap. The girl is 5 years old. Una Sally tells me she's doing this so her daughter can have a future. Nearby is Musa, who's 29, also from Ivory Coast.
In my country, nothing works, so I made the decision to sacrifice my life. My parents don't even know. I feel I have no choice.
In the Civil Guard Control Center in Algeciras, they scan the strait with cameras mounted on the Spanish coast. A new call comes in. A Spanish fishing boat has spotted another dinghy. The teams are scrambled again. Sub-Lieutenant Fuentes says they're getting up to 10 calls a day like this now, and the migrants are using more and more flimsy craft, even paddling on inner tubes and children's inflatables.
Most rescues take place in the area near Tangier. Many sub-Saharan Africans use small toy boats with paddles.
It's here, the city of Tangiers, perched on the northern tip of Morocco, where the pressure is coming from. As other routes across the Mediterranean have become tougher, more and more people are trying to reach Europe this way. On the edge of Tangiers, we find a group of around 20 men living rough, trying to avoid the police. Morocco does its best to intercept the migrant boats. Mamadou from Mali shows me the storm drains they sleep in. The men here come from all across West Africa.
Cameroon, Mali, too.
Mamadou has already spent 3 years trying to get to Europe. I asked him how many times he'd tried to cross the strait.
Four times, each time brought back. Now we don't have any money, even to eat.
Back on the Spanish side, the beach bars are full of summer holidaymakers, taking selfies as the sun is setting over the broad, sandy beach. Europe, with all its wealth, is the irresistible draw for the migrants. At the bar, two men start improvising some flamenco. Words of their song, "Don't lose hope, you will get there." Same determination driving the boatloads now trying this crossing.
The BBC's Damian Grammaticus. In many districts around the country, kids head back to school this week. And this year, in the background, is a heated debate about how to protect those children from school shootings. On Friday, U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said she's leaving it up to states to decide whether to use federal money to buy guns or provide firearm training for school staff. That's something one of her predecessors, Arne Duncan, has said districts should resist. Duncan served as education secretary for most of the Obama administration. I talked with him earlier this summer about his new book, How Schools Work. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
You were one of the longest serving secretaries of education. You were in office for 7 years. It's been about 2.5 years since. How has the education system changed since you first took that job?
We need another hour for that conversation, Amy. I'll just say this simply. Education should be the ultimate nonpartisan or bipartisan issue. There should be nothing Republican or Democrat about giving a child a chance to get a great education. And you hear none of that conversation coming from D.C. today. You just see ideological battles. You see small ball. It's nothing about helping to, you know, educate our way to a better economy.
Well, some of your critics have said that during your time in Washington, education actually became a more divisive issue. Do you think you could have done more to make it a bipartisan cause?
I think we can all do more. I will tell you, I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours with our Republican friends and colleagues and worked very closely with them. But it was candidly much more of a challenge in D.C. And I'll give you one example. The governor of Mississippi was desperately upset that we weren't able to fund pre-K expansion in Mississippi. And this was a very, you know, conservative governor. He and I may not have agreed on much else, but we simply couldn't get his Republican colleagues in Congress to support the kind of funding that would allow more money for pre-K in Mississippi and across the country. So real world, love the partnership, love the work. D.C., unfortunately, was much tougher.
So the first sentence in your book, and I know it's meant to be provocative, is education runs on lies. Explain what you meant by that.
Well, it's trying to reflect on, you know, a couple decades working in education and all the things that we say we care about, all the things we say we value, but our actions don't match up with our words. And in the book, I talk about gun violence and how much we actually don't care about children's lives. Politicians mouth lots of platitudes, but if you really look at what we're doing to give every child a chance to fulfill, you know, all their potential, really think about what we're doing or not doing as a country to keep our children safe and let them grow up free of fear, there's a massive disconnect between our words and our actions. And those are the lies. Those are the lies.
And you're working now on gun violence. In fact, in May, you called essentially for a boycott of U.S. schools until Congress passed stricter gun control. Why did you tell parents to keep their students at home?
Well, I just look at the devastation that we see, and we just continue to allow children and parents to die in our country at staggering rates, and it simply doesn't happen in other industrialized countries. It doesn't happen in Canada. It doesn't happen in Japan. It doesn't happen in Australia. And this is not rocket science. This is not finding a cure for cancer. We just as a nation lack the political will to keep children and families safe. And I'm going to challenge that status quo every single day, Amy. It's unacceptable. The trauma, the loss. I hate to say this, literally last night, I was in the hospital with one of the young men who I work with who was shot the night before, was shot Saturday night. And that's our reality. That's our reality.
Arne Duncan was U.S. Secretary of Education in the Obama administration. His new book, How Schools Work, is out now. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Have a great day now.
Coming up.
It's like me standing digitally at your front door and monitoring everything that comes in or goes out.
Creepy, right? But first, let's do the numbers. Traders had the day off as U.S. markets were closed today because of the aforementioned Labor Day, though U.S. headlines did dominate overseas trading, namely what Erica mentioned earlier, the trade talks between the U.S. and Canada, which resume on Wednesday. In Europe, Britain's FTSE ticked up 0.9%, Germany's DAX lost 0.2%, France's CAC 40 added 0.1%. In Asia, the Nikkei lost 0.7%, and the Shanghai Composite Index declined 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The unofficial end of summer also means the return of football. The regular season starts this Thursday, and some eye-popping player contracts are getting a lot of media attention. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers signed a contract extension worth $134 million last week, making him the highest-paid player in NFL history. But for some context, Jerry Jones, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, is reportedly worth more than $6 billion. In that light, Rodgers' contract sounds like peanuts.
Relative to what the owners make, it is that.
Maury Brown owns and operates the research and analytics company BizBall. He says a lot of fans don't think players should make millions just to play a game.
You know, I could play that. I played football, and we seem to think that for whatever reason that they get overpaid.
But just $100 million of Rodgers' contract is guaranteed, and only NFL stars get any guaranteed money. If a rank-and-file player gets cut or retires, his contract is dissolved. The NFL's approach is unique. In pro baseball, basketball, and hockey, the team has to pay the full amount of the signed contract to the player. Andrew Brandt teaches sports law at Villanova University. He says the teams argue that football is too dangerous to guarantee contracts.
And that's a great argument if you're management. But if you're players, why wouldn't you say the opposite? Because there's such a high injury rate, they should be guaranteed.
He says we're still a long way away from all NFL contracts being guaranteed. But with new data and science emerging about brain trauma as a result of playing the game, he thinks the owners and players will at least have the discussion about guaranteed money after the league's collective bargaining agreement expires at the end of the 2020 season. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Tomorrow's Senate confirmation hearings start for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. One potential area of discussion, how he views federal regulations, basically who has the power to write the rules that govern our society and our economy. The Trump administration has focused on rolling back regulations. Last year, 15 rules were permanently erased through a fast-track tool known as the Congressional Review Act, or CRA. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has the story of one of those 15 rules concerning internet privacy.
This guy, Cameron Camp, knows a lot about me.
Over a course of several days, we collected about 30 million records of your interactions across the network.
Whoa, 30 million is a lot. The reason Camp had collected all these records on me is because I'd recruited him for an experiment to help me understand what information my internet company, my ISP, knows about me. Camp works at ESET, a cybersecurity firm. And for this simulation, he set up this little gadget.
I'm the guy that built the creepy thing that tracked all our traffic.
I hooked this creepy thing, actually called a packet sniffer, up to my computer. It was able to collect the same information that my internet provider collects, which is pretty much everything I do online that's not encrypted.
It's like me standing digitally at your front door and monitoring everything that comes in or goes out.
Camp and my internet company can see how I work.
Probably you collaborate with a team, and I can tell to a high degree who you collaborated with.
Camp and my internet company can see what I read, some of which is kind of personal.
An article about baby bad breath, which is...
I'm
just
going to
leave that one there.
I'm embarrassed to say that my baby does have bad breath.
I'm not here to judge.
And then there's the stuff that's very, very personal.
I found an article on natural childbirth and some people that were pretty afraid of that on a site called Scary Mommy.
You could see what I was looking at?
Yeah, I'm reading the article right now. It says, enduring an unmedicated natural birth was one of the worst experiences of my life. And it says, traumatic, excruciating, horrific.
It felt creepy to hear Camp tell me all these things he knew about my private online explorations. But it felt even weirder to realize that my internet company knows all this about me, too.
There would be no other company in the world that would have this much information about you in that short a period of time, you and all your neighbors.
And as things stand now, internet providers are allowed to aggregate, analyze, and make money based off all this stuff they know about me. It's valuable to companies that want to target ads, and theoretically to companies that calculate credit scores or determine rates for car or health insurance. Now, I should say it's not just internet providers that have access to our personal online data. Facebook, Google, Amazon, they also can and do make money off of what they know about us. But there's some differences. We choose to use those sites, and we use those sites for free. When it comes to internet providers like AT&T, Comcast, or Verizon, we're paying them to use their services. And a lot of Americans live in places where there's only one internet provider in town.
You really have fewer and fewer effective choices, real choices.
There's been enough concern around what internet providers can do with our personal data that the FCC actually wrote a regulation finalized in the waning months of the Obama administration. It would have restricted what internet providers could do with the sensitive data they have about you, require them to ask your permission explicitly before they shared any of it with other companies. But then, a few months into the Trump administration, before the regulation had fully gone into effect,
I do rise today in support of SJ Res 34, which disapproves of the rule submitted by the Federal Communications Commission relating to protecting the privacy.
The Republican-led Congress passed, and President Trump signed, a bill that wiped the internet privacy regulation off the books and shut down the possibility of any future regulation that's, quote, substantially similar. And the fast-track tool used to erase this regulation and 14 others in 2017 was the Congressional Review Act. The regulations that were eliminated were a diverse bunch, from this internet privacy one to one that would have made it harder for certain people with mental disabilities to buy guns. But there's a common theme that lawmakers have brought up each time they used the CRA to quash one of these regulations, that they were doing it to stop regulatory overreach from a very specific group of people.
Unelected bureaucrats at federal agencies.
Far too much power to bureaucrats.
Overreaching, short-sighted, and misguided rules adopted by unelected bureaucrats.
The Constitution is very clear. If you're going to pass a law, it needs to pass by Congress.
That last voice is Don Nichols, a Republican senator for Oklahoma from 1981 to 2004. And in 1996, he was one of the lawmakers who created the CRA, along with Democratic Senator Harry Reid from Nevada.
If people don't like the laws that Congress passes, they can change Congress. But what was happening, you had regulatory agencies that were passing very expensive, very controversial laws by regulation. And I was offended by that. And so that was basically the genesis of the Congressional Review Act.
It turns out that today, Nichols, the guy who helped invent the CRA, is a powerful lobbyist in D.C. And last year, some of the biggest companies in the world hired his firm to push Congress to use the deregulation tool that he made two decades ago. He said there were lots of regulations to target with it.
Like a mosquito in a nudist colony, where do you start?
One of the things Nichols started with, that internet privacy regulation. In the first half of 2017, AT&T and Comcast paid Nichols' firm $108,000 to lobby Congress. One of his big issues was pushing lawmakers to use the CRA to erase that regulation. Even though, according to polls, most Americans say they want more control over how their personal information is used by companies online.
There were many folks who said, I want my privacy. I don't want these companies tracking my online behavior. Why get rid of that rule?
Well, I think you had FCC saying, oh, wait a minute, we can do that by regulation. That was clearly something that should have been done by legislation. Whether you agreed with it or disagreed with it, that's something that Congress should deal with instead of unelected bureaucrats.
But critics of the Congressional Review Act say unelected bureaucrats are a scapegoat, and that the CRA really gets used when lawmakers are pressured by well-financed groups to get rid of a regulation that costs them. Alan Morrison is a law professor at George Washington University.
The whole reason for giving these decisions to agencies to begin with was that the American people and the Congress have recognized that there is a problem that the marketplace won't solve and that Congress couldn't spend the time to get the answer right. And so they delegated the authority to the federal agencies to deal with that problem.
Morrison says fast-track deregulation tools like the CRA give Congress and the president the power to shut down regulations without coming up with a solution to the problem they were trying to solve in the first place. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You can hear the truly fascinating backstory of the Congressional Review Act. Subscribe to our documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. And this final note, back to the NFL. Colin Kaepernick, who protested racial injustice by sitting or kneeling during the national anthem, may not have found a new team, but he's one of the faces of Nike's new 30th anniversary Just Do It campaign. ESPN's Darren Rovell tweeted, Nike had been paying Colin Kaepernick all along, waiting for the right moment. The moment is now. Along with an image from the campaign of the former 49ers quarterback emblazoned with the words, believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything. Okay, we gotta go. The markets were closed today. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. And I'm Amy Scott. Kai Rizdahl's back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.